Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And what we've got in store for you, I hope you will find this at least enlightening, if not, I wouldn't say heaven's parting, but we're going to get back into common law. And we really want to dive into that very specifically. But a couple of things, obviously, I'll go quickly through the obligatories. It's now or never, folks. The debt is fraud. We go through this, read those petitions, because once you start reading the First Amendment petitions on reclaiming the Republic, you will clearly understand it, precisely how that debt is fraud. We also want to point you to the Red State Talk Radio podcast page. Right there, we have a link to a prayer circle. If you want to participate on a daily basis, it gives you the time and the link to the Zoom channel where you can actually join Woody, Loud and Liberty, and others that are participating in praying for those who are really working and diligently pushing for the reclamation of our Constitution, or restoring or reclaiming the Republic. We're not an organization, but we are a group of leaders, uniting leaders to lead in reclaiming the Republic, which is why we go to organizations, which is why we try to actually solicit all these different organizations. And those organizations that adamantly remain behind a wall of separation from the Constitution and full compliance to the entire Constitution, those groups are a part of the problem. And so we also want to go into this, you know, opportunity to get some nice furnishings. If you need speaker stands, something kind of simple on their website, because they've gotten enough orders right now that is really making it harder and harder. And I'm expecting to probably hear from this week that they've probably filled up their schedule. So you had a chance for the past, 2 weeks or a week and a half or something like that, if you wanted to get a full rack or what have you. That being said, if you really want good quality and you want solid American hardwood, I think they can get almost anything. And one of the things I find interesting is that some of the American hardwood is a lot cheaper buying it from these guys than buying it from your local. And I don't know, maybe that's just because Pennsylvania has a better source or what have you. But in trying to do this for myself and going down this path when I wanted to do these things, it cost me a lot more. Now, every Monday and Friday, we try to dedicate a little time to the presidency, a constitutional Trump presidency. And so as I look at this constitutional Trump presidency, one of the things that we really need to highlight is, you know, what did we cover before? And so let me give you a summation. On the 15th, we covered the invasion. So this way you can go listen to these if you haven't heard them. On the 18th, we covered the currency and the dangers of what Biden has done by violating the Constitution and creating FedNow and trying to push towards a digital currency. There, Trump can actually do things to actually get this nation back on the road to creating precious metal as our currency again and getting away from this global inflation. On the 22nd, we presented to you a process how Trump could literally remove the UN and all subjugation to international treaties. We're going to get into domestic and other types of treaties, but we just want to leave that there for now. The immediate appeal to the states went out on November 25th. This is an appeal to get the states to step in and start dismantling all of the unconstitutional government. They have the authority to do this, and this is why we are reading the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. It is not about nullification. The process of getting and reclaiming the republic is interposition, period. Anybody that tells you, oh, affidavits or, you know, the court or the party or just becoming a sovereign citizen or a general assembly, that is not the process. That is a process that actually will do nothing. There's no way those processes can restore our constitutional republic. Only interposition. We actually, I mean, folks, come on. I presented this in the last, excuse me, I believe in the very last episode, that bottom line, if we do not take the effort, because all things that are worthwhile, you know, the way that is the hardest is usually the most worthwhile and the one that gets you the best results. And bottom line, there's no free lunch. There's no easy way to win. We actually have to do this. We have to roll up our sleeves, and we actually have to demand our public servants. We, the people, have to demand that our public servants abide and fully comply to their oaths of office in supporting the Constitution of the United States for the United States of America. Excuse me. If you look at the organic, or if you go to our color-coded Constitution, it is the Constitution for the United States of America. That was the name that they gave the original Constitution. The Constitution of the United States, not for the United States, is the annotated Constitution, just so you know the difference. Anyway, on the 25th, we covered the appeal to the states, and then on November 29th, we talked about locking down the Department of Justice and using it in holding every public servant accountable. So today, what do we have up our sleeves for today? So today, we want to actually talk about this whole idea of the bureaucracy. In other words, the concept of the bureaucracy operating and taking land, and very specifically, out of all the different bureaucracies, the Department of Interior is the one that is problematic. And I say that because when we look at the Department of Interior, we actually are diving into the Bureau of Land, Indian Affairs, Land Management, and or Environmental Enforcement. I mean, go look at the Department of Interior. I don't want to go into the details, but Trump has the power to actually start reducing the staff and offices that are existing in the states. And as a matter of fact, this should be a part of that appeal to the states as he actually starts de-staffing, pulling people back, furloughing them, or what have you. Because what you need is you need less federal employees in your state, and you need less federal land and federal regulations. Ultimately, we want to actually cut all of the strings from the federal government regulating these sovereign states. I want you to understand, these states are sovereign over all things that are within their boundaries. Now, they have to behave properly, and the federal government is the traffic cop, or kind of like the, in a way, in mediating between the states. It is to make sure that no states are taking advantage or doing undue harm to other states. Good case in point. When we look at environmental laws, I mean, if there was one state that was a really gross polluter, the other state could say, hey, you're harming our folks. You're killing us by, you know, dumping a whole bunch of pollution upstream that is going to go into others. So the federal government doesn't have the ability to regulate that pollution, but they do have the ability and the power and authority to actually go into the state that's polluting and say, hey, you have to stop that. You have to find another means of doing that due to the fact that you are actually harming the drinking water and the aquatic life or what have you. But bottom line, they're as a traffic cop. They're not to assume regulations and laws without an amendment to the Constitution. So they can go after bad actors, states that are acting badly. And they can basically say, you have to come up with something else because you're harming. But I'll give you another case in point. when California started demanding better emissions, and they said, states, you have to make cars to meet our standards, the federal government should have said, well, then you need to start manufacturing those cars and competing with Detroit. Because you can't tell another state how to how to sell their product. You need to actually come up with a better alternative. And so for going after and saying that they can't sell their product in your state doesn't work. Anyway, so let's dive into this this common law epiphany, or I should say, I did get some feedback. So I know how difficult it is, but I also, it came to me because a few people, you know, commented and complained that, you know, all of these things at harvest time, you know, it's not that, you know, having a turkey is opulent. As a matter of fact, when you buy turkey during Thanksgiving, it is, you know, in some places, 39 cents a pound, 60. I mean, it is very affordable. And so I would tell people, wink, wink, nod, nod, you should go and buy and fill up your freezer, because turkeys, usually the way they're packed and wrapped, they usually will last for 2-3 years, because it's like a cryovac, packed in water and so forth. So anyway, my point is this, is that you're not required to have a large feast on Thursday. You can still have a good harvest meal, if you want to call it a harvest festival. But but the whole point of giving thanks is focused on actually giving thanks, not necessarily, you know, opulent or gluttony and those types of things. And so I know it's difficult. I know it's not easy to, you know, to exist in a very, you know, materialistic world. But you doesn't mean you can't have something to eat. But if you fast those first two meals and then you have a turkey meal or what have you, if you make it humble, you know, and it doesn't, when I say humble, it doesn't have to be bad quality. You can still have a good meal to share with others. But it's a far better meal shared with others when you share with others the giving thanks and the service, where you can work together in serving others and doing those things. It's about consecrating the Constitution as a nation. That was the intent behind the first Thanksgiving. All right, so let me dive into the this common law. And actually, I was in the midst of going through the definition of common law, but I think it's probably really better to kind of first, before I finish that definition, to give a macro view of I'll call it the creation of common law, even though common law was it was Britain's effort to try to emulate what Israel did in governing themselves by using the law, God's law, as the foundation and protecting their rights and so forth. And so it was a good intent, but there were some problems with it. Now, they didn't do this until, the 11th century, something like that. But it was just lipstick. And this is because at that point in time, they didn't have the Bible. It was all by word of mouth what God's word was and so forth. They never had a clear understanding as the people. They never had a clear understanding of God's law until they actually had the monarchical theocracy established in England. So in other words, the evolution of the Roman Catholic Empire's civil law to common law took a long time. Even the Magna Carta did not get them there. The Magna Carta was something that was empowering the people. And this is, you got to remember, at this point in time, when they created the Magna Carta, they really formed a republican form of a monarchy, because the land barons were the rulers of these, basically these counties that made up Britain or England. And so as they started growing and that it evolved to a point to where King Henry finally said, you know, that's it. I want a divorce and you're not going to give me a divorce. So goodbye. And that, I've covered this, that took a long time. Go look at the details, how long it took before the British monarchy was actually established as a standalone government, separating itself from the Roman Empire and establishing a new legal system. They had to have, when they established a new legal system, it was based upon the King James Version. Now, as I was commenting, and I think I wasn't commenting on the air, but if I repeat this, then forgive me. Because as I was commenting to an individual, when you really think about it, when Martin Luther migrated the people away from the Catholic Church, he did that on the facts, you know, instead of the desires, the wanton desires of the king. And so there was a greater buy-in in the Germanic states in this new form of religion, where in England, there were a lot of people that just, you know, was not happy with the king. And you'd say, well, the British people are always problematic. Well, maybe they're moaners and groaners and complainers, because that's what the America became, you know, a cast off or a child broken away and taking its own path. The DNA or that ancestral traditions, heritage, I'll just say the shortcomings, where the complaining and all of that came to be, was because when the king basically made the edict, then he was actually enforcing upon other people different views and different concepts that they weren't ready to take. They didn't buy into this. And so it was kind of a brutal shift, and it wasn't really a shift. It took time, but it was still not accepted. There were a lot of people that did not adapt to what the king wanted, which is why you see as England evolved and as the colonies just a century later, as the colonies started opening up, it became an opportunity to get away from religious persecution that was occurring in the British Isles. Folks, I'm telling you that just like Caesar of Rome basically persecuted the Christians, the king and the monarchical theocracy began persecuting anybody that didn't believe in their doctrine of Christianity. This was a part of the tempering, or I should say the tempering of the metal of the American Enlightenment, to look at with disdain this unacceptance of people having different views. And the reality is these men were very smart. There's no doubt in my mind this was literally within the minds and grasp of Madison and Jefferson and many of the framers, that when they sat in a church, they knew that their views didn't necessarily align with everybody else. I mean, I can't believe that this is the common thought just today. This had to have been actualized and realized way back then. And this is why when you read Madison's paragraph, or actually his essay on property, he actually spells out the most precious property that we have is the entitlement of what we truly believe the word of God to mean. Whether we follow the minister or whether we go against the minister in our own way doesn't mean that we're wrong. And when you're living in a state, or when you're living in a governing state where the government comes after you because you're practicing different religion, look at the Puritans. The Puritans wanted to be free of religious persecution. And then they created their own persecution within Massachusetts, because this was what we were going to worship, and nobody could ever whisper anything different. The intolerance that they imported from England, it was just a paradox, you know. Anyway, so this evolution from the Roman Catholic Empire into the civil law and into common law was a bit of a clumsy process. But bottom line, as the colonies basically evolved into and towards the revolution, one of the things that came out was Blackstone's commentaries on common law or the law. And when you look at Blackstone's commentaries, the bottom line was that nothing could disrupt, nothing could rewrite the words of the Bible, that the Bible was the supreme law, and it was to be used to interpret what the law was to be. In other words, yes, in England, they had to look at, and whoever came up with the best interpretation of the Bible regarding the law, where, and this is also where the people came in. Because the people in the monarchical republic, the people were given the power under the Magna Carta of assembling and petitioning to be able to stand up against tyranny. This became an embraced concept, which actually led them to the Glorious Revolution of the late 1680s. And so when we start looking at the late 1600s, technically the 1680s. So when we look at Blackstone's commentaries, the whole point was, and the sacredness of common law was given to the people to absolutely, as a grand jury or as an assembly or as a committee, be able to determine whether somebody committed a crime or whether the laws are being broken and a petition is required. And therefore, this evolution was actualized in the colonies at the point of the revolution. When we see what the states did, when we actually see what the colonies, before they were states, did, they formed these representative bodies. In other words, they were to create a representative body, such as a grand jury, but instead they created assemblies, councils, conventions, and or committees of safety. And then these representatives worked together in crafting the words for a petition to the king and or parliament. So they were doing everything civilly that was expected of them, and they were expecting what was expected out of the king and out of parliament to redress their grievances. And that didn't happen, and it didn't happen, and it didn't happen, and on and on. And so by the time they formed the Continental Congress, at this point, they were already leading towards independence. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to do a collective appeal. And that's why we go through the Articles of Association, why we go through the Articles of Confederation, so that you can see the change from this desire to be a part of England to this, we're done. We've created this independence, and now we've got 13 independent states, and we have a confederation now. So this evolution, maintaining common law. Now, just remember, every state at that point in time was sovereign, and every state had its own sovereign religious symbiotic relationship, I should say, where they had a state-sponsored church, and that church had a symbiotic relationship with the government, with the governor and or the governing body. Ergo, they had these little theocracies in the Confederation. Now, when the Constitution came along, it did not disturb the relationship between the church and the state. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution actually kept the federal government with the Bill of Rights from actually establishing what church that they would gravitate towards or that all would gravitate towards. They were restrained from being able to do that so that the states could continue doing the things that they needed to do. However, here's the twist. They created a new form of republican form of government. Instead of a republican form of government under Britain and the rest of the world, which was a representation of the people, they created a government that was representation of the sovereigns. Now, I'm going to go into break, so I just want to stop right there so that you can, and I've said this time and time again, that when we look at the representation of the sovereigns. That means that when we the people create a government, we recognize we delegate power, and they are the sovereigns in the capacity of those powers delegated. And so the Constitution was very integral in this whole change, and it was not a paradox. It was literally a transformation to a higher form of government. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we created, or I should say the framers, by inspiration, created a new form of government where we recognized, this is only one part of the new form of government, where in representative of the Republican form, we recognized, or they recognized, that the people's government is equally sovereign to the people because they have actually granted that power to that governing body. However, that governing body is to be legislative only, not to be executive, not to be judiciary, but legislative. So the other part of this Republican form of government is they broke it up so that the legislative was isolated so that the people had better control of their government. And ergo, when you look at the executive was not appointed by an aristocracy such as Congress. They actually talked about doing that. They talked about creating an aristocracy in America where the president would be appointed by Congress. But instead, the president was to be chosen by the Electoral College, which was representative of all of the states, so that there was no advantage to one state or a couple of states or anything else. And so when we look at this sovereign, this Republican form of government of sovereigns, representation of sovereigns, now we can see that the representatives are the superior body in our three-branch government, that the executive is to execute, and the judiciary is to deal with the infractions of the laws that the legislative body creates. They have no legislative power, nor does the executive. Now, we actually point out that the executive has negative powers by being able to veto. But can the court veto? No. They cannot veto a law, nor can they make a law. So Just that's how the Constitution in this republic is by the Constitution. We're not functioning that way, but that's because actors we've had a lot of bad actors, and we'll get into that. But let me get into now the finishing of this, the civil law. See, the roles, I was going through the definition. I'm not going to repeat what I said before, because this is just an overview and a formal definition of civil law, because this is exactly what you'll see for common law as well. In civil law, courts consider past decisions when there's a consistent pattern of case law. The more uniform the past precedents, the more persuasive the case law. How it works: the civil law courts generally don't bind themselves to a single decision, and they don't consider split jurisprudence. However, cases that don't follow the dominant trend can signal dissent among the judiciary. Again, it is about the cases and how the judges move forward. Because, see, they're basically talking here in civil law, and this is the same thing. This is basically the same definition for common law, that the courts actually have all the control, and they're looking at court decisions to be able to bend the law the direction they are, and they actually make law. In basically, when we look at civil law and common law underneath the king, because who had the legislative power underneath the king? Ah, it was his magistrates. It was those who he gave that power to. Who was the supreme jurist, the supreme judge of all things? The king. We don't have that form of government. We don't have a magistrate form of government, nor do we have an executive form of government, nor do we have a judiciary form of government. We have a representative form of government that is representative of the people and their governments, which means that this created a new... This was a huge paradigm shift, folks. And so what we're looking at is that this new form of government demanded a major shift of common law. Because common law, the intent behind common law was to maintain purity to the supreme law. In other words, all laws needed to stay in check with the supreme law of the land. In Britain, it was the Bible. However, the king was able to basically migrate that and pervert it by appointing his junior magistrates, and then basically by using case law, making the ultimate decision, well, we're going to allow this because of the trends or because of his desires and whims. That's really what it played down to. However, when we're looking at our form of government today and what we're actually supposed to have, this basically... Those who have stolen the power of our government have perverted the very essence of our common law. And so I want you to kind of understand this, because in essence, when you look at our government, who is the ultimate foundation of the power of political power in America? Who is the source of political power in America? It's we the people. And we the people create a sovereign government. It is the only government that we the people directly create, which means that the first sovereign layer, the almighty government of all governments in the United States, is the county. The county is the people's government. The county basically has the direct relationship in governing the people based on the powers delegated. Now, when we created the state government, that state government was representatives of the counties going into a convention that created a state government. That state government should have been a general government to service the counties. Now, we screwed this up. This all got perverted because of the federal government. Why counties matter most will really basically paint this picture for you. I know it's a long read, folks, but it's academic. And you'll actually see how this whole process got perverted because the federal government was more was more thirsty for taxation. I'm really sorry about my throat. But I believe that at least I'm very conscientious about this. And so I constantly struggle because I'm telling myself I'm not doing a good job because of my throat. I don't know of anybody else that can do this. And I'm not putting myself above anybody, but I just see everybody else so baked in their own concepts that they can't see the light of day. They can't see these nuances, this divine government that we were given. Everybody else is actually, clinging on to these perversions that have been created, whether it's the court and the affidavits or, these jural assemblies in a democracy. Because if you look at the jural assemblies, if you look at going down that path of a secessionist, you're going down a form of democracy. Well, I'm not buying into the government we have. We got to create a new government. And that government will be a democracy, because when you look at a lot of the people, they want to have a perpetual buy-in. In other words, they want the people to ultimately have to say and constantly buy in to everything. That is a democracy. And we already know the most dangerous form of government is a democracy. And unfortunately, Anna von Ritz and the rest of these people, they're clueless. And that's because they've accepted the government, the perverted government that has been basically concocted by bad players who have been sat into the seats, the legitimate seats of government, and perverted what those seats do. When we look at common law in our republic, it is the embodiment of the power of the people. Now, let's go back to Britain. The people have the ultimate say. And in Britain, it required the people, and actually the people had the power because they didn't have representatives. The reason why in the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights, the people could assemble and create their own representatives because they didn't have permanent representatives. Oh, they did with Parliament, but that still wasn't good enough. And so the king still allowed them the ability to create citizen grand juries or citizen assemblies and so forth. They didn't have local representation. So what they had this power to do this. Well, do we have the power to have local representation? Yes, we do. But what if that isn't good enough? When we look at the three tiers from the federal state down to the county, what if that's not good enough? What if your county government doesn't really understand what they're doing? What if, you know, we've got these problems and the county actually needs to buck against the state? Do they do that on their own as our representatives, or do we need to empower them? In other words, do we need to say, yea, verily, thou shalt not recognize that constitution? Look at the petitions and understand what sections are the steps, first, second, third, fourth. At the very end, there are 8 steps. These steps drive and empower your county commissioners to take a full constitutional stand to square up against your state legislature, to get them to square up against the federal government. This is the power given to the people to basically get a hold of their county government and actually get it right. There's many problems that we have to clean up. One of the problems that we absolutely have to clean up is the lack of a constitution at the county, where we actually delegate them these powers so that they can be sovereign. Right now, they're just administrators, even though they're a legitimate seat of representation that they should have been. We never woke up and said, hey, we need to give you our power, and we're going to basically create and then link all of the steps of this hybrid constitutional republic so that they're basically linked together or entwined, so that one can't actually go without the other holding it in check. In other words, the federal government can't start going down a path or doing something where the states wouldn't hold it in check. But see, we've lost that full accountability due to the fact that the counties were never truly instituted and established by the people. The federal government has been able to completely pervert and reverse the power of government to center on them instead of we, the people. I want you to understand that the power of the people and the sanctity of the jury, the sanctity of the representatives at the local level is preserved. The Constitution recognized that. This is one of the reasons why the trial by jury was to be preserved. They wanted to make sure that the power, that they recognized that they needed to keep the power in the people's hands, which is one of the reasons why there's a House of Representatives at every level. From the county, that's all your representatives, to the state. And if your county gets too big, then you need to break it down to some sub-element. That is something that the framers and the design of this never really accounted for, where you can actually create a state within a state. And ultimately, that may become the necessity where California in Los Angeles, maybe it becomes a state within a state. Because if the people really want to go, you know, and create, because they don't want to go with the rest of the state, then they should be allowed, as long as they have a Republican form of government and still acknowledge themselves as a state within the United States. I want you to understand this, because when you really think about it, when California breaks up, if California could actually break up to where they actually have land masses that control, you know, these counties, or Los Angeles may become its own state. But the necessity of breaking up these cities would be better suited by staying within the state and creating a county, a sub-government, to create a bicameral county government instead of a regular representation government where you have a single legislative body. Just because you have that many governments underneath, that many cities or what have you, within a highly populated county. This is something that the people and the state need to hammer out. We don't need a king deciding this. But the essence is this, that the power must be left to the people and the governments that they create. And another little rule of thumb, that government has to self-sustain itself. In other words, if it basically wants to create a welfare system, they have to pay for it at their own expense. In other words, they won't be getting federal dollars. They can't get state dollars. In other words, the rest, if they want to create their own state and they actually want to tax everybody and destroy themselves with socialism, then they can do that. And then they go into conservatorship. And when they go into conservatorship, they get broken up. And what will end up happening is they will be kept from ever instituting socialism again. Because this will happen. We covered this in Thanksgiving. And as a matter of fact, in my book, and as a matter of fact, when you look at the grand scheme of governing throughout the world, socialism in a different array of implementations has always been a trend that always people gravitate towards this. They gravitate, and actually Aristotle was the one that explained this. He basically was telling Alexander the Great that the reason why people gravitate towards socialism is because everybody has an affinity to their family, and they want to see their government function like a family where everybody takes care of everybody. It doesn't work that way. And as a matter of fact, when you start realizing that, you know, you have feuds, normal feuds between families, and I mean, Hatfield McCoy type of feuds, then how can you actually create that kind of symbiotic, or I should say synergy, when you've got that type of destructive energy as well? It is best to leave and empower the family, the basic element, and respect it and protect it, instead of actually perverting it and creating a global or a large state and or a county family. I mean, it's one thing if you actually propagate your children and you take up the whole town and it's just your family. But I will tell you, even in that circumstance, you will have feuds, you will have problems, because every family has their problems. Every one of them, and it'll actually just perpetuate. But bottom line, I went down a rat hole. When we start looking at common law today, it needs to be based upon the foundation of government established in our case. It is based upon the supreme law being our cases. The constitutions being the supreme law of the land. When we say that the state constitution must be congruent and in harmony with the U.S. Constitution, then we have two constitutions that are supreme law. Now, the problem is we have people that say, hey, look, the federal government can't do these things, so the state can't do these things. No, that's not true. The federal government may not be able to do certain things, but all powers not delegated to the state are left to the states and or to the counties, to the people's government. We can do what we want to do, as long as we're not violating it. The only real protection that the federal government really has that's applied upon the states is either in Article 1, Section 10, those restrictions placed upon the states, or those privileges and immunities that cannot be abridged by a state or local government because of the 14th Amendment. So in other words, we do have this level of protection of our inalienable rights down through every state. We don't need to have a Bill of Rights in the states anymore. We don't need to have a Bill of Rights in the county. The Bill of Rights and all unenumerated rights are all protected under the Ninth Amendment, which means your right of conscience, your right of commerce, all of those rights that may not be enumerated are still protected. Just remember that no enumeration of power in a constitution can be construed to deny an unenumerated right that was reserved to the people, your right of commerce. So when your state shuts you down because of a pandemic, because they don't want you making money, they don't want you out doing things, they're violating your right. They can't make or enforce that law. So, thus, common law was the empowerment of the sovereigns where the people hold the ultimate power. In other words, when you start looking at what do we do when things are going awry, who are the sovereigns? The ultimate sovereigns are we, the people. So when the federal government is doing something and nobody's doing anything about it, then ultimately it is your responsibility. This is why I've said this for years, folks. The blood is on our hands. It is on your hands, it's on my hands, because ultimately we are the ones that have to hold our public servants accountable. That's right there. We've been given this. God gave us this in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So let's start actually putting the rubber to the road and actually start holding our public servants accountable. The ones we have the best and hopefully the best rapport with, as well as the best leverage, is our local county commissioners, our county legislators. I want you to understand, I hope this show is coherent enough for you that you can actually make sense of this, because this is a very powerful message that when we actually create a county committee, a constitutional compliance committee, a constitutional compliance assembly, I don't care what you want to name it, because maybe you're out of the original 13 that you wanted to call them a council. Your colony or state called that body a council. Call it a council. The name means nothing. It is a representative body of the people for the local vicinage, for that county. And therefore, those people, by duly being elected into that committee, now have the power in forming that committee and will be under oath to actually do very specific things. One, to actually support the Constitution for the United States of America. In other words, the original Constitution. And then they have the job to actually do all the due diligence in going through that Constitution, the ratification debates and so forth, and then directing specifically what the supreme law of the land demands that the county do. In other words, when they start looking, they'll actually start seeing that we can no longer recognize any other constitution except for this one, because the other constitutions allow unconstitutional law to be actually applied to the state and the county. We actually have to definitize that so that the courts can't use this civil law, this, I should say, case law and precedents. That is not constitutional. That can't be applied. So go through these steps, because this is broken down in that initial committee that has to be formed in step one. The second step is basically promulgating the endorsement. Your county commissioners, once they create this committee, they will then send out an endorsement. The endorsement of these petitions, and send these petitions out to all of the other counties and say, you need to create a like committee and do what we're doing. You're more than welcome to look at the final outcomes of what we've done, because we'd love to have you basically proofread, you know, make sure, you know, do a QC check, cross our T's, dot our I's, and make sure that we didn't miss anything, because better is better. You know, and in this case, I usually say, and I've heard, and it's not my adage, but an old adage is, better is the enemy of good enough. Well, getting it done to a good enough state to get it out, I understand, but we have to make sure that we can improve upon it so that we amend and improve upon those terms and definitions of the Constitution. because as we apply the legal terms and definitions that were provided by the framers out of the ratification debates, every clarity that is added to the Constitution removes any temptation from a jurist to be able to interpret or think otherwise. And as a matter of fact, this is how it's supposed to be played, folks. If a jurist is looking at a case within the Constitution, something that has arisen under the Constitution has come to them, and they have no idea what to do, then it is their job to basically go to Congress and say, Congress, if you can't provide the constitutional standing from a, you know, from a previous, you know, definition provided by the framers, then you need to go to the states and have them tell us what to do. Because their obligation is to comply to the original terms of that Constitution. And if one doesn't exist of how that Constitution is to be implemented, interpreted, or what have you, it must come from the states, which would then go to the counties and then go to the people, and everybody would then buy into. And the beautiful part of this process, folks, is that it requires 3/4. So we can't allow, and it won't allow, California to pervert the union. It won't allow New York or any large state that has, you know, supposedly all of this people power. Every state is equal in that republic. That's the same thing at the state level. Every county is equal. When you create these constitutional conventions, these delegates of the districts of the county, they'll have one vote. You'll have three districts. Each district gets one vote. Each county at the state constitution gets one vote. You cannot allow population and democracy to creep in where you can actually start playing games. You have to recognize the sovereignty of the counties and respect the dignity and again, that sovereignty granted by the people of that area, of that county. It's the same thing at the state. When we really look at this concept of representation of sovereigns and respecting the suffrage of the sovereigns, then it really comes down to that. I mean, even though a county may have and be able to provide a greater number of delegates, just like in the state at Congress, when we look at the 12th Amendment, in selecting the president, Congress does not get each member one vote. They vote by delegation to ensure the representation of the sovereigns is being represented. So in other words, they have to vote in a delegation and they get one vote. Who do they choose? And in 2020, had the 12th Amendment been followed, Trump would have been elected because of the party politics. I'm not going to say that he was the best president. We have not had the best president since 1854 or 1852, I mean. That was the last time the Electoral College functioned. And in 1856, the Electoral College was hijacked by the party. And from that point on, the party controlled the outcome. And so this is one of the reasons why we've had nothing but problematic presidents actually beforehand and even after, ever since after, because we haven't really had a constitutional president, nor have we actually had a constitutional president probably actually since James Madison. I would give Monroe a part of the tip, but because of what he did with the Missouri Compromise, I'm just ashamed to know what he did and how he did that and how he just violated the essence. Because, folks, I want you to think about this. The sovereignty is basically this concept of self-determination, self-fulfillment. You create the state, you create your county on the how you want, and nobody should be able to tell you what you're going to be other than constitutional and in harmony with the U.S. Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.